Mary Weston was a prominent member of the 18th century Quaker community. She gained renown across the Atlantic for her edifying preaching and ministerial work, as well as for her loving care of fellow Quakers who travelled to her London home in Wapping. Mary's resolution to undertake ministerial service to the American colonies between 1750 and 1752 was particularly unusual for an 18th century woman. However, as the following paper will explore, this was an accepted part of a female minister's Quaker career, and something which was supported by both her husband and the wider community. Whilst the radical nature of such an activity clearly contradicted 18th century attitudes about the place for women beyond the domestic sphere, as the following paper will argue, it was a decision that was heavily weighed against familial obligation. What is perhaps surprising is that the life of this remarkable woman has been almost completely overlooked by the historiography. In part, I feel that this is owing to a significant void in the literature on the 18th century Quaker movement more generally, which was conventionally viewed by Quaker scholars as a low point in the development of the faith. Traditionally, it was also a period viewed as increasingly restrictive in terms of the roles that it provided for its female members. Through a combined examination of the spiritual journal which Mary wrote during her travels and the personal correspondence sent to family and friends, I aim to reconstruct the experiences of Mary Weston during her two-year voyage to the American colonies. The decision for a woman to undertake such a long and arduous journey for the truth's sake was an accepted feature of Quaker ministers' lives. Drawing upon the Protestant ideology of the spiritual equality of all believers, Quaker theology permitted women to occupy unusually active and public roles as preachers and missionaries. From 1735, Mary Weston was regarded by her local monthly meeting as a public friend, which meant that she was able to receive approval and financial support from the local community in order to undertake ministerial work when she felt a divine leading to travel. Her decision to carry out such extensive and indefinite work to the American colonies in 1750 was fully supported by her husband Daniel. Like most husbands who married female ministers, he was expected to provide the much needed financial and emotional support for his spouse while she travelled abroad. This included the care of their young daughter Mary, who was only 6 years old when Mary departed for the colonies. Indeed, his correspondence is filled with expressions of great encouragement and loving support. In one letter to Israel Pemberton Jr. in August 1750, he explained how it was a very near trial to be so deprived of one of the most affectionate and best of wives and a true helpmeet. He was nonetheless able to reconcile his wife's absence when he expressed in his words that it was a duty required by her great lord and master. He also expressed that the desire of his soul was that her labours would be crowned with success. As a public friend, Mary found that her spiritual welfare forced her to maintain a public presence within the community that could not always be easily reconciled with her natural urges to remain industrious at home and care for her young family. The Irish Quaker Abigail Watson wrote just before Mary's departure to America that the voyage in July 1750 was a very great cross to her natural inclinations. During her travels to the colonies, Mary often wrote of her impatience at hearing from her husband and daughter. In one letter shortly after her arrival in August 1750, she urged them not to be distant since our moving parting, but to write by every ship bound to any part of the continent. She closed the letter with a poignant conclusion, explaining the love she held for her small family, who she regarded as dearer to me than life itself. Nevertheless, like most Quaker women, Mary was able to reconcile her decision to travel by explaining that her spiritual calling would ultimately ensure the spiritual welfare of her family. In one letter of November 1750, for example, she expressed how she hoped that both her husband and daughter may still be sharers of divine bounty in both health of body and the influences of the blessed spirit, for which, as she explained, they were all participants. Unlike most Quaker ministers, Mary was unable to find a suitable companion to accompany her on the voyage. This meant that she was faced with the rather daunting experience of travelling alone to an unknown and distant land. While she received great comfort and support from the American Quaker community, particularly the Pemberton family, her Philadelphian hosts, she nevertheless expressed moments of great isolation in her personal correspondence, describing herself as a poor pilgrim. Moreover, as a single woman travelling from place to place, her presence as a stranger naturally aroused suspicion and even outright hostility from local Quakers. In one passage in her diary, Mary remarked about the aversion that individuals had to a woman preaching in public, which she explained brought my mind very low. This was compounded by the fact that she was not always able to find another woman willing to act as a guide for her journey across the American wilderness. Thus, when local female friends were able to offer support, Mary attributed such favours as a sign of divine providence for her ministry. In July 1752, Mary Weston had safely returned to her family home in London, having carried out an unrelenting campaign of travel to the various Quaker meetings during her time in the colonies. Her journal records the distances travelled by this brave minister on horseback and foot as being over 1,600 miles. Whilst Mary's journal concluded before her return to England, the personal correspondence sent by both herself and her husband to various members of the Pemberton family offer a revealing picture of a minister dramatically transformed by her experiences. On her return to Wapping, Daniel Weston described to the merchant John Pemberton in July 1752 how the journey had been beneficial for his wife, for he explained that she looks much better and more comely than ever. However, such a long voyage did not come without its consequences, particularly when it came to the effects of separation from her young daughter. She confided in one letter to the American friend Israel Pemberton Jr. the moving reunion she had had with her husband and child, but explained that my Polly, that is her daughter Mary, had almost personally forgotten me. Nevertheless, she explains that her safe return to the family home was a joyful meeting to us all when favoured to behold the faces of one another again. Whilst little is known of Mary's life beyond her return to England in 1752, it is clear that both Mary and Daniel sought to emulate the loving cordiality that she had received during her travels to the colonies. The American ministers Margaret Ellis and Margaret Lewis stayed at Mary's Wapping home for nearly 5 weeks after their arrival in England for ministerial service. Margaret Lewis was 4 months pregnant on her arrival and benefited greatly from the loving care she received from the couple in preparation for their visit to the northern counties. Mary's encounters during her visit also encouraged a lifelong correspondence to emerge between herself and various members of the Pemberton family. She developed a particularly close friendship with her former companion and landlady, Mary Pemberton, for whom she cheerfully fulfilled orders and arranged for the shipment of goods, which varied from fabrics and sewing supplies to shoes, clothing, and even pamphlets. In becoming convinced of her own personal access to divine authority, Mary Weston went beyond contemporary ideals about the public role of an 18th century woman, who seemingly liberated herself from the oppressions of domestic responsibilities and undertook a voyage that promoted an unusually independent and active lifestyle. Mary was clearly a strong-willed and single-minded individual when it came to her spiritual calling and personal relationship to God. As a young girl, she had lamented her parents' decision to instruct her and her siblings in matters of business, rather than favouring a close and strict religious upbringing. Shortly after her death in 1765, her daughter described her as a faithful labourer according to her measure. Friends across the Atlantic also spoke of her powerful ministry and edifying conversation. Nevertheless, the effects of separation from husband and daughter went against her natural instincts as a wife and mother. As her personal correspondence reveals, she could never fully separate her spiritual life from her temporal concerns. Whilst we are still some way from a complete revision of traditional views of the 18th century Quaker movement's attitudes towards its women, as I hope to have demonstrated, in focusing on and uncovering the life of this extraordinary woman, we can gain a clearer picture about both the opportunities and constraints that were available to 18th century female ministers in the transatlantic Quaker community.